This is George Herman at CBS News Space Headquarters in New York. Less than 5 minutes to go now to the historic launching of the Soyuz spacecraft from the Baikonur Space Complex in the Soviet Union. A historic first, the first ever to be broadcast not only to the world, but to the Russian people of the Soviet Union as well. First, though, moments ago, President Ford and Soviet Ambassador Dobrynin appeared before newsmen at the State Department, and both praised the mission. Here's President Ford.
As has been said, shortly after 3 o'clock this afternoon, America's Apollo spacecraft will be launched from the Kennedy Space Center at Cape Canaveral. And these two voyagers in space will rendezvous historically 2 days from now, and thereafter circle the globe together. It's my judgment that this joint space mission is a truly historic occasion. In my pre-launch message to the American astronauts and to the Soviet cosmonauts, I told them that they are opening a new era in the exploration of space and the blazing of a brand new trail of international space cooperation.
Watching the two space launchings separated by 9,000 miles within several hours is like seeing a science fiction becoming a fact. I have just returned a few hours from Moscow, and I can tell you that the atmosphere of great interest and expectation prevails in my country. Soyuz and Apollo, Alexei Leonov and Valery Kubasov, Thomas Stoffer, Mans Brandt, and Donald Slayton are on everybody's mind. Millions of people watch the latest TV news from Baikonur and Cape Canaveral. Actually, the whole country is taking part in counting down.
3 minutes to go now, and we switch to Moscow and CBS News correspondent Richard Roth. Dick?
George, Soyuz Commander Alexei Leonov and Flight Engineer Valery Kubasov reclining in their couches inside the small launch and descent module that's perched atop the 162-foot-tall rocket. There's no special name for the rocket. The Russians call it simply the Soyuz launch vehicle, and it's not too different from the rocket that was used 14 years ago to boost Yuri Gagarin into orbit as man's first space mission. It's a tall, thin white structure with a red band around the middle and a mast at the side of the rocket that carries liquid oxygen propellant into the 24 engines. And from what we know of the rocket, that mast and the liquid oxygen connecting lines won't fall away until the ship is actually off the ground. At the bottom of the rocket, four long cigar-shaped parts. They're just visible. The rocket is hidden partially. It's sunk into a pit about 20 feet deep in the ground. Those cigar-shaped parts are the strap-on engines, and they fall away shortly after launch as the staging process begins. Interesting about the start of this rocket launch that's different from the Saturn launch vehicle carrying the Apollo is the fact that the Soyuz rocket is standing alone. There are no hold-down arms to restrain it, just four counterweights that will fall away from the rocket as soon as it develops enough thrust to move off the pad. We can hear some interpretation of what Moscow Mission Control is saying.
Now, the booster tanks, or the oxidizer tanks on the booster rocket are being vented. 1.5 minutes remaining before launch.
With 1.5 minutes remaining before launch, everything here has been reported smooth all morning. As I was saying, the counterweights fall away just as the rocket begins to develop enough thrust to move off the ground. And since the rocket is not restrained by any hold-down arms in the way the American vehicle is, aiming it becomes a little more difficult. 1 minute before launch now. And the aiming of this rocket is accomplished by a launch pad that tilts slightly, so the rocket is slightly inclined and will be taking off over the mountains of southern Siberia. The mast, now support mast carrying propellant, has just fallen away.
30 seconds before launch. The launch command has been given.
The launch command has now been given, which means that Soyuz is now committed to launch. Soyuz is standing completely alone now. It's just a silver, white pencil standing in the middle of the desert or the Baikonur Cosmodrome. There is a description now from Moscow Mission Control.
The engines are powered up.
water weights have just fallen away. It's a flash of light, and the rocket is moving off the launch pad.
Moscow time, 15 hours, 20 minutes, 10 seconds. The flight is proceeding normally.
And Moscow Mission Control says the flight is proceeding normally. George?
All right, Richard, what do we get next from Moscow?
The next thing that we'll see will be the confirmation that four of those strap-on engines have fallen away. That's essentially the first stage of this rocket, which has fired successfully. When we hear that, we'll know whether the flight is continuing on course. It's headed now over the mountains of southern Siberia towards the Chinese border.
All right. About how long into the flight do the engines, the strap-on engines, fall off?
2 minutes into the flight, George, the strap-on engine should fall off, and we should have confirmation that the core of the second stage of the rocket is still firing. That will continue for another 6 minutes and 40 seconds.
70 seconds of flight.
We now have 70 seconds into the liftoff, and then the third stage will ignite, and that should burn for another 4 minutes. In other words, about 13 minutes into orbit.
Okay, standing by at the Cape, Reed Collins. Reed?
George?
Yes.
People down here are very much excited over it. We've had quite a bit of activity, and...
Are you getting any more information than we are?
Applause.
Are you getting any more information than we are, or has it all come through the one Soviet commentator?
It comes through the one line, through the one interpreted line, George, and we don't hear any more than you do. But the same general scene is being followed out over the Central Asian place that we follow out here, except that we have the advantage of being over water. And if they have to come down, they have to come down on land, which they, of course, have planned to do if they had to.
Also, you don't have to tilt the whole flight pad to direct your rocket.
Well, no, of course, it is guided and steerable itself.
Must make it a little difficult for the Russians if they want to change the course of their rocket. They have to build a whole new launch pad.
Well, I think that they have considerably sophisticated steering mechanisms. They get into that rather high inclined plane, which takes a little more energy, especially up at the...
Dick Roth in Moscow. Come in.
We have confirmation now that the strap-on engines have fallen away, that the crew is feeling an overload from the G-forces of liftoff, and that the second stage is burning normally.
Now, that second stage is what we would still call part of the first stage. It's the central engine of the first stage, or have they separated the second stage altogether?
It's the core that comes right in the middle of those four strap-on stages. We call it a first stage. They consider the strap-ons a first stage.
Yeah. So we really consider it to be sort of a two-and-a-half stage rocket.
That would be correct, yeah.
All right. When do the Soviet people think they will announce the course that has been achieved by the takeoff rocket?
That's one of those imponderables. This is still considered by the Soviet side, a unilateral part of the mission and some kind of metaphysical distinction that's drawn. And there hasn't been a great deal of detail about Soviet rocket launches that's been given to us.
The second stage engines are operating.
I'm trying to listen with you to the Soviet commentator.
George and Richard, this is Reed at the Cape. Their rocket is a lot like our old Atlas, really, in staging and in using the strap-on idea and igniting almost everything at once.
Right, Reed, and the disadvantage of that, of course, is that their liquid oxygen propellant is also controlled by one pump that feeds each of the four engines in each stage. If the pump goes bad, that means all four engines are lost.
Over 3 kilometers per second.
Well, as far as everybody can determine, they've gotten off on time and apparently in the right direction, and that's most of the battle, isn't it?
So you, in about another 4 or 5 minutes, should start loading your cryogenic fuels down there at the Cape, Reed?
That's correct. It has a little bit of expandability to it. It's a hot day, and I imagine Paul Donnelly and the other people don't want to put it all in there too quickly and then stand around. There's no goxing, and there's no confirmation that the actual propellant has started loading.
One thing thing that we haven't had yet, we've had word that the flight is proceeding normally, but we haven't heard much from the pilot Leonov and the flight engineer Kubasov, and there were plans originally for us to hear from them. We do know that flight director Alexei Yeliseyev is at Moscow Mission Control, and he's been nodding and doesn't seem at all worried. Seems as if everything is going well, though.
Well, it's a good sign, I guess, if you have to study the Kremlinologists by nods and smiles. Too bad we can't get the detail that we get, those endless reports it sometimes seems from the Voice of Apollo down at the Cape.
George and
yes,
Dick, I believe we do have confirmation of staging. That is, they have dropped the first stage, which we call the half stage, and now they're on the final flight plan. And this puts them past the point where the April launch got into trouble and couldn't get rid of the expended stage, and they had to come back down, if you recall. That is, they aborted in flight.
Right,
they'd gone beyond that milestone.
We're now almost 6 minutes into the flight, and all still seems to be going well, right, Richard, in Moscow?
All signs are that everything is going well here.
All righty. This space shot, I'll just remind everybody once again, this space shot is just starting one day short of 6 years from the launch of Apollo 11, our first man to the moon shot, which sort of signified the end of the space race and really, in a sense, laid the foundation, historical foundation, for this joint space venture today, which both President Ford and Soviet Ambassador Dobrynin once again this morning reminded us is an historic occasion, a great moment, although I noticed that neither of them put much emphasis on the scientific aspect of it. Reed, is the opinion on the Cape that this is a scientific attempt of any importance, or is it really more a political and diplomatic coup?
Well, you don't say that for publication, but I believe it's recognized that this is a political venture, and they want to utilize it as much as possible. Therefore, it is festooned with experimentation, and some of it Soviet-originated, and some of it ours, and a lot of it unilateral on either side.
I don't see why it's not popular to say it. It seems to me a diplomatic advance is as important to the world, perhaps, as a scientific advance.
I guess the politics is a dirty word in somebody's mind, George, but it's true. This is really the thing we worry about most, and the thing that we're spending most of our income on is international politics,
George,
if you look at it in the broad
scale. Okay, let's go to Richard Roth in Moscow.
We have word now that the third or the final stage is burning normally. That should go for another four and a half minutes or so now. We are now past the point where there were problems in that aborted Soyuz mission. Rocket's now moving at about 8 miles a second, and it's about close to 1,000 miles away from the launch site.
Sounds good. Reed, we interrupted you.
Well, no, I think we finished the idea of saying it is a political idea, and that the concept is rooted in international politics, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Okay, I'll just remind everybody in the audience that we have listened to an historic first, the broadcast of a launching of a Soviet spacecraft. First time, to my knowledge, they've ever announced the crew, first time they've ever announced the time, first time they've ever set themselves up for having to admit that something has gone wrong. So we've had the successful liftoff of the Soyuz space rocket. This afternoon we will have the liftoff of the Apollo spacecraft from Cape Canaveral, on which we will again hear from our colleague Reed Collins down at the Cape. And then in the succeeding days, the additional details of this historic mission, the link up in space of the two spacecraft, the Soviet spacecraft and the American spacecraft, all part of our continuing coverage of Apollo Soyuz, a meeting in space. George Herman, CBS News, Space Headquarters, New York.
Apollo Soyuz, a meeting in space. I'm Reed Collins, CBS News, at the Kennedy Space Headquarters in Florida. When the American half of this mission is about to begin, the astronauts Thomas Stafford, Vance Brand, and Donald Slayton are in the Apollo spacecraft out there on Pad B. It stands on a Saturn 1B rocket, which in turn is standing on a spider-like launch pedestal bathed in sun. The access arm that leads from the launch stand over which they walked is now swung completely away. We are less than 5 minutes from liftoff of this, the last American chapter of manned flight, the first joint mission with the other major power. The launch director, Walter Capron, will tell you that now that Soyuz 19 is safely up there, the pressure is enormous to get the Americans off.
the pressure is quite great. As a matter of fact, the pressure on me is more from on top, from my management, than it is from the actual operation itself. We have learned quite a bit in the last year to year and a half with respect to electrical fields aloft and with respect to levels at which lightning gets triggered and with respect to levels at which you can trigger lightning and still not hurt the vehicle.
But Walter Kaplan need not worry about lightning, at least not for the present, because there's a big arena of blue up above the launch pad. No real weather threat here except far out at sea. Some high cumulus clouds are building up, but they're far to the east. Astronauts who have been inside for more than 2 hours cannot see for the protective boost cover over the command ship, though. The commander of this flight, Thomas Stafford, the space veteran, now an Air Force general, 44 years old, is over in the left-hand couch. Stafford's able to put aside the ideological differences in this.
As far as the pure politics between the systems of government, we have made a special effort that we keep that out of this mission. As far as the implications, it's really a visible demonstration to the world that you can work together on an effort if you put good faith into it and live up to the agreements.
We're 3 minutes away now in the center couch. Vance Brand, 44-year-old former Marine fighter pilot. Brand has learned the Russian language better than his companions, and he sees this mission as a wedge into the future.
I think that it's important that we make this first step in cooperation. We don't all know what it will lead to, but there are a lot of fruitful areas that could be open to us.
And over in the right-hand couch lies Donald Slayton, known to everybody as Deke. An original Mercury astronaut, grounded by a heart murmur for years, Slayton finally has won his clearance for flight, and he's grabbed the last one. At 51, he's going to be the oldest man to enter space. Slayton likes the Russian people, but he is outspoken about the system.
I think they've got a lousy system of government. I don't want any part of it, but I think their people are friendly and very compatible to work with, and we've got good working relationship.
And so these men are about to pioneer the attempt at high-altitude detente, a mission that has cost this country some $250 million and will close out America's manned presence in space until the space shuttle of the 1980s. The rocket itself, the ninth 1B Saturn model ever to fly, it's 224 feet tall, standing out there, goxing away and waiting for its moment. It's an old-timer. It was built in 1967. Let's join now as we come up to 1 minute and 35 seconds, the voice of Mission Control here, Chuck Hollingshead.
Deke Slayton will put two switches in the spacecraft to bring the spacecraft batteries online. These batteries will give added electrical power and also are a backup to the fuel cells. At the 1 minute mark, the water will start pouring onto the flame deflector underneath the pad, and at 30 seconds, we'll get water on the mobile launcher deck itself. Deke now has brought those batteries online, T-minus 1 minute, 6 seconds. The last action performed by the crew will be a T-minus 45 seconds, and at that time, Tom Stafford will make a final guidance alignment. T-minus 55 seconds, we'll be getting switched to internal power shortly. All of the tanks now pressurized, and we're switching to internal power. Stafford reports he has made the final GDC align. First stage, second stage, and instrument unit now on internal power. Approaching the 30-second mark in our countdown, water pouring onto the flame deflector, now coming onto the deck of the mobile launcher. Everything proceeding smoothly. We'll get a guidance release at the 17-second mark.
20 seconds.
The engines will actually start. The engine sequence starts at 3.1 seconds in the countdown.
Thousands of people now have gathered around the boat base, and all eyes, literally thousands, are riveted.
Eight,
seven,
six,
five, four. We should have ignition very soon. We have it. We have it. And I believe we have a commit, and we're moving. Lift off. Clear of the tower. Clear of the tower. She's on her way. Listening now here. Voice of Tom Stafford. Clear blue up above, just a faint sketch of cloud behind it. The old sapphire flame of the eight engines of the Saturn 1B pushing her up, cleaving the air above. It's a beautiful sight into a bright, bright sun, into the roll program now and out of it, looking for the correct azimuth to catch Soyuz, which now is about 1,000 miles east of Newfoundland.
the keying. We're listening to see if we can hear some word from the rising astronauts, the last Americans.
Follow now 3 miles in altitude, 1 mile downrange.
Stand by for mode 1 Bravo. Mark, 1 Bravo.
1 Bravo,
Roger.
Cabin pressure coming down.
Roger.
Cabin pressure relieving as expected, coming up on the region of maximum dynamic pressure.
The big jolting up there as she begins to form a contrail.
Through max Q, everything's still looking good.
Then your feet wet on your way.
Roger, feet wet.
Feet wet means if they had to come back, they'd come back in water. The contrail is formed and now it's left as they've gone through a thin, high cloud cover. We still see the flame
seconds,
of it.
Still looking good, 6 miles downrange.
Roger.
Follow Houston, you're mode 1 Charlie.
Roger,
1 Charlie,
Dick.
That's
fine.
Nurse.
MP Frank getting a status for staging. Go for staging.
Houston, you're go for staging.
Roger, go for staging.
Go for staging, we may be able to see it with the naked eye.
And we have a report that we are losing some data here in the control center.
Outboard.
We've lost data from the command module computer. Trajectory still looking good.
There's staging and the outboards
okay,
are shut down.
And that line is out on the 4B.
Roger.
We got acceleration.
Roger.
Hello, Houston, we've had a PU shift and thrust is up on S4B, looking real fine, right on the money.
Roger, Dick.
That's Dick Truly in Houston, talking
Captain
to Tom Seppert.
Dick Truly advising the crew that everything looks good on the Saturn second stage.
Tower jet, there she goes.
Roger, tower jet, in your mode.
And the launch tower no longer needed, has been jettisoned as planned.
Okay, we got the steam running with the water. Guidance is initiated.
Roger, confirmed.
50 miles in altitude now, 80 miles downrange.
The voice of Mission Control in Houston, Texas, telling us where we're going and how fast and how far.
Guidance looks very good at this point. The command module computer data is intermittent now and everything looks good.
People beginning to drift away. People actually leaving the site here as though they've decided
now,
that the show is over.
Downrange.
Although, of course, for those 3 men, it just begins.
30 onward trajectory looks good, Dick.
Roger, Tom, concur. You're looking real good.
All right, they're climbing up and out, and we are now completing the second half of the mission that began really 7.5 hours ago, way over east of Moscow at Baikonur, that once mysterious place, which we're learning a little bit more about all the time. My colleague correspondent, Richard Roth, is in Moscow, our CBS News Space Headquarters there. And, Richard, I'd like to ask you how it seemed from here to there.
It seemed very dramatic, Reed, and the flight controllers on the Soviet side at Kaliningrad, just a few miles away from us in Moscow, were watching very intently a large screen that showed the liftoff of the Apollo spacecraft. There were no smiles, and they haven't broken out any cigars yet. I don't know if they plan to do that here.
Maybe our mission control neglected to send the cigars that far.
Perhaps. I'd like to tell you a little bit about Soyuz 19 that the astronauts are going to go up there and meet. It's being described here as a nominal mission. And as far as the Soviet press is concerned, there is nothing at all happening abnormally. There are a couple of small problems that we've heard about. Apparently nothing of major concern at this time. The first was with a television camera aboard the launch and descent vehicle that the cosmonauts rode into space in. And that camera was supposed to have shown pictures during launch. It did not. The cosmonauts were told that after they were in orbit, and they said they'd check it out. A while later, Soyuz commander Alexei Leonov moved into the orbital module, the upper portion of the Soyuz, which will be the main work area for the Americans and the Russians in space. And he tried another camera. That also didn't work. It may be a systems problem. And they were told that they would be given time later in a few hours, probably, to try to isolate the cause of that camera failure. The only other thing that we've heard that seems a potential problem, or seems to be some kind of a minor difficulty, is that Leonov has complained about noise in his voice communication system. That complaint came about 2 or 3 hours ago, and we haven't heard it repeated.
Well, Richard, I suppose we have to get used to the fact that not everything works exactly as planned. I know that the Americans have been leery about putting an ascent camera in an ascending spacecraft for fear of an abort that might jerk the thing loose and have it floating around in there doing damage. But I think this was a Soviet idea, the ascent camera, and it's a pity that from the Soyuz point of view it did not work. We should mention maybe that there are plenty more cameras available, nearly half a dozen of them, and they'll come into use particularly Thursday, when the real rendezvous and docking and the apex of this mission really begins to come off.
That's right, Reed. The only thing that we're wondering about here, and we haven't been able to get a confirmation on, is if it is a system problem, there is that fourth camera that's mounted outside that the cosmonauts, it really provides the cosmonauts the only view of the approaching Apollo during docking procedures. It's not a problem, really, in that Apollo is the active partner, but Soyuz won't be able to see much if that camera doesn't work.
Well, they have a periscope, I believe, don't they, Richard? Maybe that will do just as well instead. But at any rate, I think we have to count everything a signal success when you get two successive spacecrafts launched in the correct orbit, and our men are approaching orbital speed and distance right now. That's a big plus, is it not?
I think that there is no argument with that, and I think it's being regarded in much the same way here. A Soviet friend of mine came by just after the launch of the Soyuz, and I congratulated him, and he offered his congratulations to me, and then he paused and he said, well, maybe I'm too early, and then he thought better of it, and he said, well, I'm sure I can offer them to you in advance.
I think that's been the general theme of things here. I've never seen quite this many people in the press viewing area. I guess they become more apparent because now they've all moved out of the bleachers, and they're wandering around and probably trying to figure out how they're going to face what bids to be one of the biggest traffic jams coming out of the Cape area in some years. But whoever was here and whoever was there and whoever listened heard the closing of an era, Richard, as far as American spaceflight is concerned. But the Soviets, whom you are covering, seem as enthusiastic about manned flight as ever, don't they?
They do. There was a Izvestia this evening, the government newspaper. It's a four-page newspaper, and just about two full pages were filled with coverage of the space mission under the headline in red, Soyuz Apollo Orbit of Cooperation. And there were front-page pictures of the cosmonauts suited up as well as the astronauts suited up. And on the back page, the words and music of a new song here called Rendezvous with the Cosmonauts. Any songs like that there?
No, Richard. In fact, you can't orchestrate in a Western society the sort of thing that the TASS and the government news monopoly can orchestrate there. I must say that there was a contrast that was deeply evident to me. Back in 1962, on a marquee in front of a motel down the strip at Cocoa Beach, there appeared the phrase, "The hopes and prayers of the free world go with you, John Glenn." That, of course, in reference to the upcoming Glenn first orbital flight. Today, as I got up in the middle of the night and passed that same marquee in front of that same motel, it read, "Cocktail hour, 5 to 7:30. So I think that bespeaks a little bit of the attitude which we have adopted toward what has become a fairly common occurrence in this country.
Maybe that's détente, too.
Maybe that's détente. It could be occasioned by a number of economic factors that perhaps Mr. Marx and Mr. Lenin could have told us more about. I'm not sure.
There's someone we haven't seen before among the flight controllers now at Kaliningrad near Moscow, and that is a woman in a bright red dress. One of the interesting things about the Soviet cosmonauts is that they've, whenever we've asked them about why there hasn't been a second woman in space, they said, well, the work is too hard, or when the men get tired, that'll be the time for the women. And we didn't know there were any women flight directors, but we see one now.
Well, we, of course, in our chauvinistic way, have counted up women, and we've done some features, I think, on the number of women engineers employed by NASA and those in the launch control centers, and we have a share of them. There are an increasing number of them. And I suppose perhaps we just don't take note of the fact anymore, but this is a thing that has evolved over the years rather quietly. While we're speaking, Richard, we're still getting more information. Perhaps we should get back to our astronauts and see how they're coming. Everything has been so smooth, so nominal, as they say, that we haven't really been concerned at all once they left sight.
Apollo Houston, in about 30 seconds, we're going to have LOS from Bermuda, so we'll lose our S-band, but we'll keep you on VHF at Newfoundland.
All right. Okay, in Houston, could you double-check band C? I'm not sure. I'm sorry. I'm still showing some air particular.
I'm sorry, Deke. You're going to have to say again, please.
Yeah, Bat West D, they came off of the Bat West tie. I'm still showing some average. Could you guys confirm that it's in fact off?
Deke Slayton troubleshooting some battery indications he gets. Over there on the right-hand couch, docking module pilot.
Roger,
is his
Deke,
title.
You're okay. That's average from the EDS. And when the down at the bottom of the list, when you get the fuel cell reactance valve to normal, that'll go away.
Thank you.
No problem.
Very soon we should have the confirmation, and I think we're just about to get orbit confirmed. We don't know exactly what the parameters of it are, but it must be very, very close to what they want. The Soyuz, Richard, if you're still with us, Soyuz performed a small corrective orbital maneuver, I believe, a couple of hours back, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It was about 3 hours after... A little more than 3 hours after it blasted off from the Baikonur Cosmodrome. However, as has been the case here, perhaps an oversight, we have not been able to receive any details on that orbital maneuver. Soyuz was supposed to report to Americans on the status of that short burn, and we haven't heard anything back here from the NASA people on what happened. Maybe you have.
I believe that they're pleased with the result there, and that they have pretty well confirmed in Houston that it did what it was supposed to do and did it on time. But the interpretation requirements and the immediate in-time translation, I believe, has been handled reasonably well. I don't know how the English into Russian translation is going over there, but I believe the Russian to English has gone swiftly, accurately, and concisely here.
It's been impressive here, Reed. The only thing that I can think of that happened that caused some initial confusion was a reference during the launch sequence to what was called a flight overload, indicating that the cosmonauts were experiencing more G-forces during acceleration than they had anticipated. And it turned out that overload was the English translation of the Russian phrase indicating G-forces. It was not an overload, it was slight G-forces that they were actually experiencing. I imagine a thing like that will crop up every once in a while during the next few days.
I believe it will. There are some people who are very proficient in both languages who still have to take some special remedial lessons in the technology area, because most Americans don't perhaps know all the English for that. And then your Soviet compatriots also have some acronyms that they've invented for their things, haven't they?
They do indeed. Reed, I'm wondering what the Soviet flight observers are doing in the United States, a distance from where you are. But here in Kaliningrad, they're smiling. They're wearing their red, white, and blue in considerable contrast to the Soviet flight controllers. We're all dressed in suits and ties. The Americans are in very snappy red, white, and blue caps and white knit shirts with stripes and emblems and badges all over them. And they're watching from a second room, a separate room in the Kaliningrad Center.
Richard, let me interrupt and let's hear the voice of Anatoly Dobrynin, who is speaking here in our launch control center.
Wake up, shake hands, and I could tell that now Russian cosmonauts are preparing already or warming up the dinner for your astronauts. Well done, and thank you very much. The best wishes to all of you, and of course to both of our team which are there up in the cosmos. Thank you very much.
And Anatoly Dobrynin has set a sort of old space first of himself, the first Soviet official to accept an invitation, although we have extended many in times past. to come and witness an Apollo launch. And he, of course, was the guest of the president earlier in the day. We are running out of time. The astronauts are really eating up the ground. They're in orbit. They are safe. The next signal event is to take place, of course, Thursday when they rendezvous, dock together in Apollo Soyuz. Continuing coverage of Apollo Soyuz, this is Reed Collins, CBS News, Kennedy Space Center, Florida.